Welcome to the Mystic Cast, where you join me, Jack Stafford, a student of metaphysics and member of the Aetheria Society, the cosmic religion for the Aquarian Age, as we break down the barriers between religion, science, metaphysics, philosophy, all of which are really only aspects of the selfsame quest for truth. Please note, this is an independent program not produced or fact-checked by the Aetheria Society. Today is our 100th episode, and to celebrate, we have a very special episode. We have the Executive Secretary of the European Headquarters of the Aetheria Society, Richard Lawrence, in conversation with TV, science presenter and author, Dallas Campbell, to discuss science and spirituality.
So how should we kick things off? How did you guys first meet?
How did we meet, Dallas? Were you...
Well, I think I got in, did I get in touch with you? I'm a Richard fan, a long time Richard fan, so... I can't remember. Oh, I know what it was. I think I was really nervous, actually. I'm going to send Richard a message because I wanted to, I was filming up in Scotland and wanted to know. And I knew the Aetheria Society had links with, yeah. And I'm not sure what I can't remember what the links were, but I think to do with Loch Ness. Anyway, I left a very tentative message on somebody's answering machine, not expecting a message back. And lo and behold, as if by magic, I heard Richard's dulcet tones. And so we got chat. Actually, that first time we chatted for ages.
It was great.
Yeah, and then you invited me down for coffee. We had coffee in your lovely office in West London.
What's great, though, is that Dallas brings, the scientific background to the table. And so this is like a science and spirituality podcast, I think, Jack.
Yes.
Combined. And we're both interested in the others as well. So
yeah, they say what the metaphysician.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a science broadcaster, and I look at things from a science point of view. But I've also been fascinated by the Aetheria Society for a long time. So
I'm interrupting you, Dallas, but I did a couple of shows with your predecessor on Sky at Night with Patrick Moore.
Yes.
The late Patrick Moore. I don't think he was as nearly as open as you are, but we certainly had a couple of interesting shows. Once on, I think, GMTV and somewhere on the BBC. So I did meet him a couple of times, but I'm sure you're bringing in the new aspect is what was needed there. So I'm delighted.
Well, I never met Patrick, but one of the reasons I always really liked Patrick when I was kind of growing up, and I grew up watching The Sky at Night, and Patrick, he was part of the furniture in the UK in terms of science presenters.
Yeah, because there'll be people watching who don't know, what that is. I mean, they don't know The Sky at Night, BBC or anything. So yeah, it's a...
Well, very briefly then, The Sky at Night is a BBC astronomy television program. I think it's the longest running television program ever. It's been going since
1955,
I think, the same length as the Aetheria Society.
Wow.
The year before Sputnik, which was 50, so maybe 55 or 56.
Yeah.
Somebody will tell me. And it was Patrick Moore, who was an eccentric British lay astronomer. So he wasn't a professional astronomer, but he had this great love of the night sky and talked like this very, very fast and had this great voice and just became sort of part of the kind of the furniture of British broadcasting. Anyway, that series has been going since, I guess, the 1950s, if I'm correct. And I occasionally present it, not all the time, I'm not the main presenter, but we do a Sky at Night question time with a live studio audience, and we have scientists and we answer.
Right.
Questions about astronomy, but occasionally I do other episodes. In fact, we did one about the Star of Bethlehem actually quite recently. So that I know you've got things to say.
That's one of the big spacecraft of history. Alongside, I would say, an even bigger one actually, which we're not so familiar with in the West, maybe, which is the Pushpaka Vimana, which is from the Ramayana. And is the essence and basis, I believe, of the Ramayana, for those familiar with that Hindu Sanskrit text. It's amazing. It goes down as a legend, but I believe there's a lot of truth in it. And one of the tasks that Rama actually had was to retrieve what is openly described as a space satellite in the Ramayana, which actually quite a large craft, which had been captured down in what is now Sri Lanka. And he had to retrieve it and take it back to the Himalayas, which he did. So this isn't new. That's the first thing I'd say about the whole UFO debate. And I don't think it gets much more ancient than the Ramayana, actually.
No, that's the thing. People have been seeing things in the sky as long as people have been looking up in the sky, as far as I can tell. You know, I mean, obviously there's biblical references to the to UFO. What do you call them, by the way, Richard, these days? Because it's
call them UFOs just because that's what they are called. It's quite inaccurate because some of them aren't unidentified at all. Some of them, I mean, the Star of Bethlehem was definitely identified by three apparently very wise men.
Apparently.
So, we can't question that. But and of course, all the stuff that's come out of America, particularly America, but it's not only America, last year and before in the last few years, they're a very much identified craft. But still the term UFO, they've tried to rename, you know, invent new terms, and UAPs is the current one they're using. But I think that's just rebranding, really.
It's funny because if you go back to the late 1940s with the first or the beginnings of the UFO movement, the
flying saucer.
What's his name?
Really?
Yeah, they were. It's like, well, they're called flying saucer. What was the name of the first flying?
1947 was the first disc shaped flying saucer.
Yeah, the guy's name is as. In fact, I did a Sky at Night about
Kenneth Arnold.
But anyway, Kenneth Arnold. Thank you. But the Kenneth Arnold. It was flying saucers, and of course, Kenneth Arnold, as far as I can remember, didn't describe them as flying saucers. He said they flew as if a saucer was being skipped across the water.
That's right. Yeah. And then the term came in, and then you had Roswell in the same year.
Same year.
And the whole thing took off.
Then they became UFOs as a way of kind of rebranding it from flying saucers. Now they've kind of rebranded it again.
But I saw a flying saucer last year, Dallas. I think after I met you. So I may not have even told you. I don't know. Yeah. And it was a flying, and I may not have told you, Jack. I'm not sure. But it was the classic dish, and my wife was with me. And it's interesting because it was the anniversary of the first ever flying saucer campaign rally, which took place on August the 23rd, 1958, and was led by Dr. King and demanding that governments tell the truth. And of course, in those days, they were mercilessly ridiculed. And so that was in Trafalgar Square. We went down on the anniversary of that last year. And we, on August 23rd, and filmed in Trafalgar Square, along with a couple of my colleagues and friends here, Jamie and Ayub. And we put a clip up, and we spent the day, as it were, celebrating that event. What would it be? The 65th anniversary. I think I've got that right. And we put it out on TikTok, and at least I didn't, but they did. And it went out. But that night, that very same night, Alison and I left our house as we normally do for an evening walk, my wife, Alison, and walked out. And there it was. I mean, it was just passed over us in Fulham. And it was, I mean, we couldn't see the portholes. I have met someone who has seen a flying saucer close enough to actually see the portholes. But we did see the disc shape and the sort of raised central part as it just flew past and went above our heads. So that's the first time I've ever had a sighting which you could call the flying saucer shape, and it was on that anniversary.
But I've got a question. This is, of course, me being the skeptic here.
Sure.
Could that be
don't worry.
I'm sure. Could that be because you'd been thinking about flying saucers all
no.
day? And so
no.
that's in your head.
It couldn't possibly be that, no. Because Alison and I, we actually, as I say, we have an evening walk, and we're always on the lookout. Pretty well every time we have a walk, we're on the lookout. And we're very skeptical ourselves. That may surprise you. So, I mean, we are looking for it not to be a UFO, not to be a flying saucer, to be an aeroplane, to be a satellite, of course, to, you know, an Earth satellite, to be a meteorite, to be a Chinese lantern, to be lights from a rock show, all the things that it can be. A drone, of course, especially now. It took us completely by surprise. We weren't expecting it. We weren't looking for it. We weren't hoping for it. I mean, it didn't really matter in one way to us because we're full believers anyway. But I think it was, well, significantly timed, because that rally 65 years ago was called a flying saucer rally. And there we were seeing Odisha. We have had other sightings, and some you don't know. They might be, they might not be. But if we can possibly rule it out as being anything else, I mean, after one sighting I had, I spent the whole morning phoning air traffic control depots and all to see if it could be a drone. I mean, we're looking for it not to be a spacecraft.
I totally appreciate people seeing things and things being unidentified, but I do question, because we're so easily fooled, particularly when we have strong emotions, we are liable to
fool. I quite agree.
And that's the thing. I mean, there's the bit in the beginning, I think it's in Hamlet, when they look up at the clouds and go, oh, methinks it is a camel, because they see shapes. And we see things all the time. Mm. And so I wonder, you know, this idea that governments are hiding things, because there's no way of proving it. If the government weren't hiding anything and they said we're not hiding anything, at what point do you believe them rather than saying...
Well, that really, I mean, yeah. First of all, I agree with you, by the way. First of all, I do agree there can be wishful thinking and people want to believe. By the way, there can be even more so the opposite. I think that there are people who don't want to believe. They certainly don't want to think about it, and they are trying to explain it away. That I've come across many, and some of the explanations that people have come up with are ludicrous. And I mean, I learned that early on because I had a sighting with hundreds of other people actually in Hull when I was at university there. And it was an object moving slowly in the sky. It wasn't delineated. It wasn't like this sighting I've just described. It was kind of what they used to call a cigar-shaped object. And it moved slowly across the sky. And I say it was seen by hundreds of people. I remember then, and we're in the 70s here now, the chemistry professor at Hull, who had nothing to do with this whatsoever, felt it incumbent upon himself to explain it away. And so he came out and he said it was a barium cloud, which sounded very good. And that was published in the local press. And then they found that a barium cloud can't possibly behave the way this did. So you get both. You get what you said. You get the other people. I mean, even Patrick Moore himself. I mean, I wouldn't want to remind him of this, but I did an interview with him. He didn't believe then there was alien life anywhere in the universe. And he said that, and everybody knows he was wrong then. So just because you're a scientist and astronomer, it doesn't mean you're not going to be corrected later.
You're absolutely correct. Absolutely. But the thing is about science, for all of its flaws, for all of its faults, that the whole premise of science is that science changes its
mind. Of course.
Based on new data coming in. And I suspect, you know, Patrick died a good few years ago now, and a lot has happened in the world of astronomy and space flight and technology. Mm. We know. I think when Patrick, I forget when he died, the idea of exoplanets, for example, we knew about exoplanets, but we haven't seen exoplanets. It wasn't until the late 1990s that the first exoplanets became visible because of our technology. Well, not visible.
Yeah.
And so we now know there is a lot of real estate out there. So I haven't met a scientist who thinks there would be no life out there. Nor me.
And I think Dr. Helen Sharman, you know, the astronomer, you may have met her, I don't know.
I know Helen very well.
Well, you know, I think as you told me that. I mean, she made this amazing statement 3 years ago, I think it was, that she believes not only in alien life, but that it could be here now and it could be invisible. And this, you know, I think there are scientists are making assumptions as well. They're acting on a certain type of faith as well. And can I just finish my point here?
Of course, sorry. Yeah.
Their faith being that the only thing out there has to be physical. So if you're looking at exoplanets, and I think they found, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, I think 16 now that have habitable zones or could have habitable zones, something like that, by which they mean that's where there could be life because of the temperature, because of the existence of possible water, liquid water, etc. But there's an assumption in that. very thought, which is that unless there is life as we know it, there is no life. And there's mm-hmm. assumption that it has to be not only in the same physical premise. I know things are evolving now and they're looking at gaseous planets and so on, but a lot of people, unless it's like us, no life can exist. And that's not that different from what Galileo was dealing with 400 years ago.
Well, we have to be careful with the Galilean argument, because the Galileo argument is always like, they thought Galileo was crazy and he turned out to be right. Doesn't therefore mean that...
No, of course not.
...one's argument is right.
No, of course not.
But when we're thinking about that question as scientists, is there life beyond Earth? We have a data point of one. So all we have, all we can look at for certain is life on Earth, and we can understand how life on Earth formed. We've got good ideas about that happened. And then we sort of extrapolate that out. So as you say, looking at things like the Goldilocks zone. But scientists don't say beyond that there cannot be life.
And the Goldilocks zone, just so people know, is the habitable zone. In other words, where life as we know it could exist.
So, for example, the JWST telescope has looked at exoplanets recently, and planets which are very, very different to Earth, a lot bigger than Earth, and have detected in the atmospheres, because we can look at the biosignatures in atmospheres. We can see things like methane. We can see things like carbon dioxide. All those things that could be life. We know there are carbon molecules there, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But the job of science is to always be rigorous about that. So say we've seen that, mm-hmm. and then we try and disprove it. We say, well, what else could it be? So for example, a couple of years ago, we looked at the atmosphere of Venus and thought there was biosignatures in the upper atmosphere. So not methane, I can't remember what it was, but everyone got very, very excited. We discovered life on Venus, well, in the upper atmosphere. Mm. And it turned out, well, actually not quite. There was some, you know, and that's the sort of job of science
science does know, you know, it's dealing with, look, I'm not a scientist. Let me be absolutely clear. You're a scientist. I'm not a scientist. So
I'm not a professional scientist.
I know a lot about science, which I don't. I know a little smatterings of it. But the very premise, I don't know whether you're familiar with this, of yoga, of what they call Gnani yoga, which is the yoga of wisdom, very ancient, very advanced practice, actually, if done correctly, is that it's premised on applying logic to your meditations, or if you like to use another phrase, to your spiritual realizations. Because I think, Dallas, there's just one thing, which is truth. And whether that truth be a spiritual truth or whether it be called a scientific truth, it's the same thing. It all should be part of the same thing. But the difference, I would suggest, is that the advanced spiritual seeker, and let me again agree with you, there's a lot of erroneous, I think usually well-intended, but still erroneous beliefs in the spiritual world, especially in the mediumistic world. And I covered a lot on my podcast, Spiritual Freedom Show. So I'm the first to say, I mean, you've got to make the difference between, you know, somebody hearing voices because they're suffering from schizophrenia or some other mental health condition, and someone who's advanced and trained in a disciplined manner to be able to tune in to higher impressions from another level. They're chalk and cheese, and there's a lot in between. So absolutely, one has to be careful. But the premise, coming back to Gnani yoga, is it's rooted in the meditations, it's rooted in the spiritual experience, and then you apply logic to that. So there should be no contradiction. The logic shouldn't contradict and won't contradict, because both logic and spiritual realization in the end lead to the same truths. That's the premise of Gnani yoga. With the scientific approach, that whole spiritual realization meditation stage is missed out completely. And so you're dealing with the facts that are accessible to you in the way you've described, and you look to see. But there are things that you can't know through that process, as such as higher dimensional life.
There's definitely things that, you know, science, you know, but the thing is, I think, you know, science doesn't claim to know everything.
No.
The thing is, first of all, science isn't a thing. Science is, as you described, it's a method. It's
process.
A way in a way, it's a kind of, it's a lens. It's like a corrective lens that says, okay, humans are really biased in all kinds of ways. We've got all kinds of beliefs and all kinds of ways of thinking. How can we look at nature in a way that best kind of filters that out? So forget about whether something's true or not. So what we do as scientists, we look at data, we look at evidence, we publish it openly so other people can look at what we've done and so that other people... In fact, this Venus thing is a really good example of that, of how science... And I'll tell you why. They got excited because they'd seen these interesting spikes. It was phosphine, actually, in the upper atmosphere of Venus. And they said to themselves, well, that's interesting because the only really way that we know of phosphine appearing in the atmosphere is biology, really. There are other methods, but they saw this. And so, of course, but then they were very cautious. And so they published, they said, we're not saying it's aliens, but we've seen these interesting things. And of course, everyone got very excited about it. And more people looked at it closer and more evidence came and more data came. And they realized it was, I can't remember the exact details, some kind of an anomaly. Right. And that's kind of where we are, rather than just saying, okay, it's definitely aliens because we've seen this.
And again, it's the pursuit of life purely as we know it or as we can detect it physically.
Yeah.
Well, that's the remit of science. But I believe that there will be a merging between the spiritual, what you might call the spiritual sciences, and the physical sciences as we move forward. Because we have a big division here on this planet between the physical world and what metaphysicians call the etheric world, you know, or the mystical world, you might say. Depending, since we're on Mysticast, let's say the mystic world. That's a big division, but we are told, and the basis of what I'm saying to you now is a man, Dr. George King, great master, someone I knew very, very well. I was very privileged to be not only a disciple of his, but a friend of his, and he was a great yogi. His starting point was what I talked about earlier, the spiritual realization, and then to that he applied his logic and his life's work, actually. But based on what he discovered, on, say, Mars, on, say, Venus, since you mentioned life on Venus, they don't have the sort of barriers between the physical world and the etheric world in the same way that we do. They are aware of both all the time. And as it so happens, they have moved and tend to inhabit higher spheres, which, as Dr. Helen Sharman observed, your friend Helen, said that, you know, can be invisible. So they won't be detected by physical science unless they choose to be.
Well, I don't know what I know Helen well enough, I think, so I don't want to speak for Helen because I don't know. What she's saying. But Helen is very precise with her language,
right?
And a very committed scientist.
I've got the exact quote actually because it's in one of my books. So.
Okay, well, but I mean, the thing is about life, alien life being here already.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure Helen didn't mean it in like, oh, we've been visited by kind of extraterrestrials.
I'm not saying she did. I'm just picking up her invisible point, that's all.
No, but actually, a lot of scientists think that actually if you want to find alien life, why bother looking elsewhere? If you can find a biogenesis here on Earth, because if we imagine all life on Earth is ultimately connected down to a single universal common ancestor, a single point, if you like. If you can find another one of those, so basically examples of life starting on a particular planet twice, then categorically you can say, well, if it happens twice on one planet, then it's going to happen everywhere.
Yeah, and of course,
I suspect that's what Helen was referring to.
All I know is that she said it could be invisible, and that's the one point I'm taking up, and that's a point actually that Dr. King made. Or was made through him actually in 1955 in the Caxton Hall in London by an intelligence channeling through him by the name of Aetherius, hence the name Aetherius Society. Now, if I say that to most, not you, because you're an open-minded gentleman, I know that from our dealings, but if I were to say that to Patrick Moore, were he here, or if I were to say that to a lot of scientists, they'd immediately blank it out just because I've mentioned channeling. A high, you know, through a medium They rule, they pursue it no further. And that's a big mistake because they don't know that it's false. Yes, I actually think the majority of claimants are false, by the way, that I've come across. But they're not. But when I say false, it doesn't mean they're lying. They might well believe it, or they might have slightly misinterpreted it, or something like this. But they don't know that. And so a true scientific, or let's say a quest for truth, if they want truth, would be to analyze it, look into it, check it out.
Well, if there was a way of analyzing it, I think the problem comes, and it's a semantic problem, it's a language problem, because with the spiritual side of things, for example, there's nothing that's testable, really. There's nothing like, you know, there's been lots of examples of scientists trying to test paranormal claims, and they always, you know, you'll know this.
You know, of the problems there, I'll come back to that, if you'll let you finish your point, though. What I was going to say, I was thinking about that the other day, because and some of the university programs where they've tested paranormal claims by getting psychics in and, you know, they're checking them with cards and et cetera and testing them with this, that and the other. I was thinking that because over Christmas, I was playing a particular game, you know, board game with my sister, which we've done for years and years, and other family members. And, you know, I was thinking I could try and use psychic powers on this, but I didn't. I have tried in the past, but all I know is it doesn't work very well because psychic abilities aren't meant to be used in that way. They aren't. I'm not saying it never works because some psychics would say they have had laboratory results and so forth, but it's not what it's there for. It's there to heal. It's there to guide. It's there to inspire. And if it starts to be used in the academic process,
but I would argue that science is there to inspire. I would argue that science is there to inspire and to heal.
And I would hope so too. And indeed it is. And indeed it is. But I'm talking here about the process only. Yeah. The methodology of the tests I have seen in the paranormal field. The best methodology would be to, and you say, how can you test it? You can test it through your own spiritual experience, which is really a development of empiricism in a way, you know, for Sir Francis Bacon and so forth, you know, testing things from nature. You can do that in the spirit, in a spiritual way, and you will get results, which you will know. Now, others might not believe you, and they might well disbelieve you, but that doesn't matter if you've had a real, genuine experience. But it's got to be a real one.
Well, I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. But what I do know is that humans are easily fooled. Not fooled, because that's a sort of pejorative term. I don't mean being foolish or being tricked. Yeah. But we all have experiences. We all have that tendency of, I suppose, a sort of religiosity. That sense of their
being. You know, I think the opposite. I think that's true of some. I don't think all. I actually would have a disagreement with you there because I think the tendency, especially in this part of the world and in the educated world, is the opposite. I think people have a tendency towards skepticism, a tendency towards disbelief, which is an energy itself, skepticism of that nature. Sorry.
But I'm skeptical, but I still have profound emotional responses when I see beautiful art or I listen to.
Of course.
Or, you know,
that's not challenging, though, is it? That doesn't challenge your life.
It doesn't challenge my life, but I understand. So, for example, if I go to a Catholic mass and, you know, you have this wonderful space and there's music and there's, you know, you can't help but be moved with that. And likewise. I totally get it. But what I mean is, but if you want to really understand nature, you have, in a way, you have to sort of park that to one side. But that doesn't mean...
I don't think you have to park it.
Actually. Okay, no, you're right. You don't need to park it.
You have to question it.
You have to question it because all the scientists I know, and I know lots of scientists, are also profoundly emotional people and, you know, and are touched by nature and art. And science has that same awe-inspiring nature that touches us. You know, you go out on a moonlit...
And some of the, you know, the medical and the other outcomes from it are stupendous and inspiring.
Yeah.
I fully agree. I was only there talking in the terms of experimenting in an academic environment with psychics. That's all I was referring to.
My question to you, and if Dr. King was here, I would love to ask him this. No. Why is it then that there is a kind of a separation in a way? Why does the spiritual side of things not speak the same? Like, why could...
Yeah, no, Dr. I think King, that's a great question, and he'd love to answer it. And I tell you one thing he actually said. And I think Einstein might have said it before him, but I don't think he knew that. But he said there is no religion without science, and there's no science without religion. But you know, I would break it down. I think where we're going with this is why I brought up Jnana Yoga and the and yoga is a science if it's done properly, and often it isn't done properly. And generally now it's just done for your physical health, well-being, and so forth. That's not the root of it at all. I think the difference is the inner search, the search within yourself, and the outer search, the search in the physical world of matter. Mm. And that both are essential. And so spirituality, one of the things that Dr. King was very keen on was to manifest in a practical world spirituality, not to go off into a cave and just experience it in silence yourself alone, but to bring it out. And as you might know, he even invented a battery, a physical piece of equipment in which energy, spiritual energy, can be stored and released. And we did do this last year during the terrible, terrible situation in, you know, over there in Gaza. But when we did do it, you might remember there was 1 week in that awful conflict when actually hostages were released. I think something like 300, I think, or more. And where aid did get in, and that was the very week that we released this energy from these physical containers, and we can pinpoint the time and the day and so on. And so that, you know, someone could say, well, that's a coincidence. You can go on using the coincidence argument forever and ever and ever. But if you believe in statistical evidence, you can see spiritual actions having an effect. You can see it very clearly in healing. I mean, there are many, many people who will testify, and disbelievers who with no faith involved at all, who have been healed. So spirit, that's the inner abilities being applied in the physical world. I think the problem it has been, and it was very marked in the UFO movement when I was first involved in it, by the way, is that the physicists won't go to the spiritual side, and the spiritual person won't look at it practically and scientifically. But you're right. The two are one thing and their truth.
I always really loved the idea of batteries as a way. You know, you think about, we now have electric cars. The idea that...
I know.
There's a historical point to this as well, that when Dr. King began this in 1955, technology was going through this great change, this great revolution, obviously nuclear technology as well. The idea that you could collect and store prayers in a battery and discharge at a later date somewhere else is such a terrific idea. It's such a
great idea.
A good idea.
and it's something we do, and we're still doing. We did it in his lifetime, and he actually, a war stopped, but it was nothing like the Gaza. It was a small war in Cyprus, but it did stop within 8 hours of the release. Now, you know, with spiritual energy release of various kinds, you don't always get an immediate result. So I'm not claiming every time we do everything you get a result. But what you're looking for is something above the average, something which is having an effect more than you might, you know, anticipate statistically. And so, you know, that does work. And it's a wonderful thing. And it's shown, Dr. King was very practical. I mean, you would have been, you'd have been impressed if you'd met him, because he had his feet on the ground. He had a great sense of humor. Yes. And he didn't like the, as you might say, the airy-fairy spiritual approach, which has been very common, or, you know, the flower-toting yogi in the long robe who blessed everybody but didn't get engaged very much. He didn't, I mean, I do remember him meeting such a yogi When Prayer Power was taking place, and I was very new then, I didn't know him like I knew him later. But this yogi came up a hill called Holston Down that we go to, and we regard it as a holy mountain. We take the battery there. I think we had 100 and something between 160 and 170 people up there last year, and years ago, this yogi in long robes came up to Dr. King, and he went up to Dr. King, who was there in his jacket and his trilby hat and his, you know, getting the battery positioned and everything else. And in the 70s, and he said, you know, he said, Dr. King, I've been to the Godhead. So Dr. King turned to him, he said, did you take your hat off? and then he said, okay, so you've been to the Godhead. So now you know that all is one. So the only thing to do is to serve others. And that's what we're doing here today. And that was a very short, a sense of humor, but absolutely sums up his practical approach.
And fundamental to the Ethereum Society is that idea of serving others and helping.
Absolutely.
And there is nothing, you know, for all me talking about science and what have you, and the differences between looking at the world spiritually and scientifically, at its heart, it's about helping people. So I'm a friend of the Ethereum Society.
I know you are. We appreciate it.
So please don't. These are not criticisms.
Feel free. We're on a podcast. We've been invited by Jack. I'm sure he wants us to disagree on something. Don't worry.
One of the reasons I'm interested in Dr. King is, as you say, he's a very practical person.
Very.
And the fundamentals of the Ethereum Society, there are these wonderful sort of practicalities that we discuss. Just talking about yogis, it came to my attention. One of my favorite stories when I was a kid was a Roald Dahl story called The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. And they just made it into a film on Netflix. What's the director called?
Wes Anderson.
Wes Anderson, thanks very much. And I loved it. And central to that story is this character learns how to see without using his eyes. And in order to do that, he hears about this yogi who lives in India, tracks this yogi down, witnesses the yogi levitating. And I always as a kid was fascinated by this idea, this yogi levitating, and it was being witnessed by this, you know, this young pupil. And I'm sure I've heard you talk about Dr. King, who was practiced yoga for 10 hours a day, being able to do similar stuff.
He levitated. And it was witnessed by his niece, who I met when she was a child. I don't know how young, I'm going to say 10, 11. She saw him look, and his mother was there. So just the three of them there. And he was in a siddhasana or in a posture, and he just raised up off the sofa or the chair he was sitting on. Yeah.
Which kind of goes back to my earlier question, which is if you can do, if things like telekinesis or being able to levitate, whatever it might be, why not let it be studied by scientists? Like, would Dr.
Well, they can
King
study
be...
it, and they should study it. Or the only point I'm making is that the process, the academic process, isn't very successful sometimes because these things aren't given for people's fascination for their. There's a wonderful story by the great Sri Ramakrishna. If you've heard of him, he was a Hindu saint in the 19th century and a very, actually, I believe he came from another world, as a matter of fact. And his famous disciple was Swami Vivekananda, who is quite well known among yoga people. They came to America. But he told a parable of a yogi who had a student and climbed a wall. And the student was watching him and he looked over the wall. And the wall, the other side of the wall, was heaven, if you like, nirvana, if you like, the ultimate samadhic state. And he looked at this, over the wall, and looked at the student. And the student saw the look on his face for a moment. And then the yogi jumps over the wall into this garden of enlightenment. And that look on his face was enough to inspire the student to make the same quest and to climb the same wall. And it's a brilliant little parable, because what it says is he can't describe to the student, and in a very, very small way, I know this quite recently, actually, over the last year. If you have a what you might call a samadhic experience or a deep meditative experience, you will never, ever be able to describe it, because it's actually beyond mind. But what you can do is you can show the effect it's having on you. You can live it, and hopefully that will inspire someone else to do it. And these things, the levitation, the signs, the visions, the various things that do and will happen, they'll definitely happen in one way or another if you pursue this path, and you will know that they have. We had a chap who came to Prayer Power, Operation Prayer Power, which is what we call the charging of these batteries, who's been doing it for decades. And he came last year to a session, and he's an elderly gentleman. But he actually experienced for the first time, he could hear the energy flowing through him, which is a clairaudience. It's a psychic. Now, he doesn't claim to be psychic at all, but he had this experience while he was at that battery charging it. And, you know, that's something that's happened to him. Now, people can believe it, they can disbelieve it, but he knows it from his own experience. And that's really what these kind of things are designed for. They're not designed to prove to a skeptic or to anybody, because I have found actually that in the end, do you think all those professors are going to say, okay, yeah, I've seen it now. Yeah, levitation works. So I'm going to spend 8 hours a day practicing yoga? No.
No. Well, that's the thing. It's a different, and you know, if people benefiting from it isn't something that should be questioned or challenged, or, but it's that thing of like, crikey, if people could actually levitate, you know, imagine what we could do with that. If we could take that thing and
yeah, we could and governments have tried to do that, haven't they? With psychics,
yeah,
they tried to use astral projection for one thing. That's come out of the, I think it was Czechoslovakia. Certainly, some papers were released by the CIA.
Yeah, there've been lots of psychics.
Definitely been. They've tried to, and you can see why. And I'm sure it's used now far more than we think.
Yeah. Can I just ask you, actually? I mean, about Dr. King's background, because he comes, like, his mother, and my information comes from listening to your podcast. So,
right.
His mother was part of that kind of spiritualist movement of the early 20th century.
Much more so his grandmother.
Right.
So it was his grandmother who was, as you might say, his favorite relative, or the relative he used to like to spend time with. Hmm. And when he was born, actually, the day he was born, his grandmother turned to his mother and said, "This child is not of this earth." And that, I believe, was a very true statement, actually. But that's another story. But his grandmother so would tell him as a boy, when he stayed with her up in, I think, near Redcar, right up north, and Middlesbrough, up in that area, lots of tales about psychic things, spirit. And she was a medium. In fact, I believe she at one time was a medium for Lloyd George at one point.
Had his own medium.
Well, he certainly wouldn't publicize it if he did, I'm sure. But
enough, a lot of the Russian cosmonauts, there was a medium called Madame Globa in Moscow.
Oh, yeah.
All of the cosmonauts, particularly on the Mir space station, had a direct line with Madame Globa, and they would ask all kinds of advice. So there's a lot of...
Goes back to Rasputin. He had some
power. Yeah. And it's funny, because I actually, just while we're on the subject of mediums, I've been to a couple of launches in Kazakhstan on the Russian space.
Oh, really?
So I was there with Tim Peake for his launch.
Oh, yeah.
Same rocket that Helen Sharman went on. And all the press, just before the launch, there was a Russian priest who comes in full black robes and blesses everyone with holy water. It's wrapped up in spiritualism and mysticism and all these sorts of ideas, even though, you know, you're talking about modern rocketry.
In a communist nation. So, yeah. But, I mean, that makes sense to me. Yeah. I mean, because I think, you know, what I've found is that when I've had But what I don't, because as you know, I've done a lot of psychic things, and I used to do a lot of readings decades ago, actually. I still do them just occasionally for a friend or something, but I don't do it so much now, but I haven't got time really. But I know that it works. I mean, I absolutely know that it works, because I in fact, I met somebody about a week ago who told me about a reading I gave her in the early 80s when I just started. And she told me just how absolutely accurate it was and described what had happened. I never, you know, remember these things, but you can't make it up. Yeah. You can't go and sort of reveal the name of somebody's uncle and what happened to them and how they look. And if somebody could say you looked it up before you met them, they can. You get all the cynics, the disbelievers think, but you know you didn't do any of that. And so it's a real thing if you develop it. And the beauty of it, though, it can be controlled. It can not only be developed, it can be controlled. And you can learn to switch it on and switch it off at will. And that's the yogic approach. That's where I was very, very fortunate, because even in those years, I could, and I told Dr. King many of these things as they were happening. And, at one point, he corrected me on some things and put me on the straight. Straight and narrow, and I know it works. I know it can be done. It's not something everybody needs to do, but it is real. And I think that's where we've got to get to, where science and spirituality merge and meet, and they're joined in this pursuit of truth.
I went to a medium once when I was about 18.
All right.
It was really interesting, actually. I must have just finished my A levels, and I was with a friend. We decided to go to this. Well, I can't remember what her name was.
Yeah,
but it was interesting actually, and she told me like a bunch of stuff, and I wrote it down. But my problem is now, because she told me all this stuff, I'm constantly looking
to do
the stuff that she told me about.
Yeah.
It's really,
or to not.
Well,
do
she said, because all the stuff is still in my head. So she said, you're going to somebody called such and such is going to be really important to you. What was it? Andrea.
Okay.
Then you met anyone called Andrea, and I'm like, no, maybe you're going to be really important. It's really,
or maybe she was wrong, because there are.
Maybe she was wrong. I
am skeptical about a lot of me, even though I do it myself. I'm still skeptical.
There was recently, I forget her name. A lot of things kind of when they go on stage, in theatres, they have mediums in theatres.
Yeah.
And a lot has been proven. They're wearing earpieces and they've done research on audience members.
Sure.
And there seems to be a lot of charlatanism, if that's the right word, in that kind of entertainment style of medium.
That's what I said to Uri Geller once. I said, when I did meet him on one of these shows on television, I said, you should do a show. Showman or Shaman?
Nice. Good title.
But he didn't do it.
The thing is, I like.
But that's what you get. You do get people who they're half magician, conjurer,
magician,
and half psychic, and it's all then it's being used for entertainment, which again is not its purpose. It's there to help. It's there to help you in your development and open. If people want your guidance, and only if they do, to help them in their spiritual life, really, and in their life in general, but mainly in their spiritual life. Mm.
I want to come on one of the battery charging prayer.
You're panels. Welcome. Come and observe it. Come and observe
I've
it.
I've got to ask. I mean, those. When I think battery, I think like a double A or something, or
I think Dr. King was clever like that. He would use existing terms and words that people can relate to. They know about an electrical battery. Now, this is a spiritual energy battery.
What's it made of? Are we allowed to know?
Well, all I can tell you, I can't tell you exactly how it's made, because there's a very precise mechanism involved in making it, and that is classified for a good reason. In fact, for the reason that you mentioned earlier, and then I developed on with governments, it could be misused, and these things could be, they can do good, but they could be used to do harm. Unfortunately, that's true of magic in general. And so real, not of conjuring, but of real spiritual magic. So, but I will tell you there are crystals is a major component of it. And another major component is gold.
that's worth some money apart from anything else.
Yeah, not that we lose money. We lose money by doing the missions we do. We don't make money from them at all. They're all designed for humanity and they're loss-making. Yeah.
But there's a great drama. I mean, I haven't been to one of the prayer power sessions, but I've seen them being on television.
Yeah.
There is a great drama in it. There is something.
There is a real presence. You know, I remember going up one time up this whole stuff. We do them in various locations, in London, in Barnsley, in Michigan, in LA, in Auckland, New Zealand. But we also take the battery to Holston Down, usually every year. We did last year. And I remember a TV crew coming up. I think it could have been BBC. So some years ago, probably in the 80s. But they came up. They didn't believe in anything at all, really, of this nature. But they felt it. And they said so. They told me, I can really feel the power. Because after all, what we're using is mantra. And we're using this book here, The 12 Blessings, which was, and this is a controversial thing to say, but who cares? It was channeled by the Master Jesus through Dr. King. And by the way, it's way, way ahead of that any teaching he could give when he was physically on Earth 2,000 years ago. It's far more advanced. It's got a cosmic concept in it. It will tell you some of the biggest revelations, and particularly, I would say, in relation to the galaxy, but also in relation to what God really is, that you will find anywhere at all. But in there are a number of prayers. So we use prayers delivered in this way in 1958, and then we use mantras, which are more associated with Buddhism and possibly Hinduism, combined, and a great power is generated. And you can feel it's tangible. It is, as you say, it is quite dramatic, but it's coming from the heart. Matter of fact, just to finish that point, when I started doing it, which was when I was in my late teens, when I was up at Hull University, I was doing drama course, and I had to kind of reprogram myself, because when I started praying and there was people around, and you know, I was like the actor with an audience in my subconscious. And that doesn't work. It's got to come from the heart. It's got to be real. It's not an act. And then you generate the power. It's a tangible force.
I'm curious, like, do you have run-ins with the Christian believers, the fact that, you know, you say...
We try to avoid run-ins, Dallas.
Well, not sort of, I don't mean sort of like punch-ups in the car park.
Well, they're not always delighted, you know, that we think Jesus came from Venus.
Yeah.
But there again, I did have actually, there's so much you can, I don't want to bully, frankly, Orthodox Christians, because it's too easy and it isn't necessarily helpful to them. That may sound very patronizing, in which case, please forgive me. But I came up through, I was confirmed by the Archbishop of Canterbury. Yeah, I was at King's School Canterbury. I was thinking of being a priest at the time. I was 14. And I found then at the age of 14 that the dean of the cathedral couldn't answer three extremely basic questions, which I assumed he must know the answer to. And he didn't. And you can always tell when someone doesn't know the answer.
Is it okay not to know the answer to things?
Not in my opinion at the age of 14. About such fundamental things. I mean, I'll give you an example of the question. They're the sort of questions you others have thought, I'm sure. If Jesus is the one and only Son of God, what happened to the people who were born before him? Why weren't they given the one and only way? Why would God allow them to exist and create them and not give them the one and only way until 2,000 years ago? That was one question, which I assume. No, I think that's not a little thing you can not know. That absolutely blows it wide apart for me. And it did then. And I was, by the way, very unhappy about that. But the advice that he gave me was roughly along the lines you might have been suggesting, which is, look, don't worry about this. You're going to have questions you won't know the answer to, and you'll get used to it. So just don't worry about it. And at the age of 14, that was, and there were two other questions I had as well. I was not good enough. Sorry?
It's a good question. You know,
I think it's not a sort of an optional question. I think if you're going to come out with a statement, which they did, I'd not say that all Christians do now, especially at the sort of liberal end, they might not say that anymore. But if you're going to say this is the one and only son of the one and only way is through Jesus, you've got to know what happened to the people before Jesus and why they weren't given that. And what then was the point of their life then at all? You've got to be able to answer that, I think, to be a proper religion, in my humble opinion. And I think so. I'm sorry if I'm probably offending people.
No, I mean, the thing is, if you're not a Christian, it's very easy to pick holes in things because
then I'm not trying to pick holes. I wanted to be a vicar. Yeah. I couldn't go into a pulpit in my mind, not knowing. I know the answer to it now, but I did. You know, I found it through other means. I then turned to Eastern religions, and then I came across Dr. King actually as a yogi when I first came across him, and I found all the questions I asked, I fully answered and more. Yes, there's going to be some things you won't know the answers to, or there are some things you take maybe on faith because you've seen so much proved to you, you don't really understand this point, but you accept it because of its provenance and what you've discovered about its provenance and its, you know, the truth of it. But a big thing like that, no. That was one. Another one was, what about the people who live in other parts of the world who never hear? Similar question. The one and only way. They might be in a jungle somewhere, never hear this message. That's the only way. What's the point of it? And then the other one was this, which is very important to me, which I fully know the answer to now, was that no one I've met belonged in heaven or hell. And, you know, I in those days, heaven was described for you, basically. You know, there was harps, there was angels, there were grapes, I think. Sounded a really boring place, but
you're
know,
in harps.
And then hell was, you know, stoked by devils in a fiery pit and so on. And I said that, look, I haven't met anyone really belongs in either of those places. And most people that I know, they want to follow football. They want to know, you know, this and that. So what happens to people who don't belong in heaven or hell, basically? And he didn't know at all. He waffled a bit about purgatory, didn't know much what it was. That I fully know now from my own personal experience, where they go and what they're like and how that works. But he couldn't answer it. And I do think if you're going to be, you've got to be able to answer some fundamental questions, really, if you're going to set yourself up as the way and the truth and the life.
I think that's maybe the mistake, setting yourself up. It's the way, the truth, and the life.
That could be their mistake.
You're opening yourself
maybe
up.
Maybe they don't know. But in terms of the Aetherius Society, which I represent,
yes, of course,
questions such as those are fully answered, and many others too. And I wouldn't want to represent it if they weren't.
I mean, I'm pretty clear about what happens when we die. You know, I was dead for 18.5 billion years before I was born. So I'm kind of and it didn't bother me at all.
And you're going back to the Big Bang, Dallas?
Well, exactly. You know,
but come on, you know better than me. The James Webb Telescope has discovered galaxies which existed before the Big Bang.
I don't believe that.
Well, that's been put out there anyway.
Well, I'd have to look.
I'm not a scientist, but I've caught this news. And if you're saying it's not true, so be it. But I heard they think they've detected a time earlier than the Big Bang. Anyway, I'm getting off your point here.
No. I mean, no galaxy format. Well, the thing is, before the Big Bang is a bit like saying what's north of the North Pole. The language breaks down.
Yeah.
There isn't.
But you gave a date there. Was it 18 and a half billion years?
The age of the universe as we know it changes. You know, every few years ago, add a bit, take away a bit, add a bit.
I think they might. Well, anyway, I have caught this. It like in the last 2 or 3 weeks.
Send it to me and I'll have a look at it.
I'll have to find it again. But it's come up on various places that they think they've detected galaxies older than the date of the Big Bang. That were formed before then.
But it's in which case they're probably saying the Big Bang was. I'd have to look at it.
Either way, I think it's a lot older than that anyway, because there's a multi-dimension. Some of the galaxies you can't even physically detect. So.
Well, this
and planets. You can't
part of the problem with science as well is that science is becomes very not very sort of counterintuitive, particularly things like the quantum world, the science yeah. of the small, and likewise on the macro scale, yeah. things like you know how time and space behave at the macro scale.
Yeah,
we've grown up; our brains have evolved in a sort of Newtonian space, kind of in between the two.
Yeah.
And so what happens is I've noticed that the more esoteric groups tend to latch onto that and go, aha, look, quantum strangeness. Therefore, that sort of proves my whatever it is they're saying. And I'm like, no, just because science hasn't got a handle on it completely, just because we have words like dark matter because we don't understand what's going
on. I'm glad you mentioned dark matter.
Doesn't therefore mean that your theory about whatever is correct.
No, can we actually go to dark matter now you've mentioned it? Because I think I've got an interesting theory. Okay. It's only a theory of mine. I'm not speaking on behalf of the Ethereum Society at this minute. It's my own opinion I'm giving here. But based on my study and my experience, I will say, of studying the 10th blessing in this book, which is the galaxy, which is an absolute groundbreaking moment in this whole book.
I know it.
That reveals that the galaxy is a living intelligence. That, I do believe, is the missing link in ecology, by the way, the fact that the Mother Earth is a living intelligence. That should be focused on, in my opinion, far more in ecology than it is. But in cosmology, the galaxy is a living intelligence. I believe that. And I have had some meditative experience along that line. But I think it's interesting that there are two things which science has, and you can correct me if I've got this wrong, virtually invented because they've had to invent them. One is dark matter and the other is dark energy. And the dark matter, I think, is it 4% of the universe is visible and the rest is either dark matter or dark energy, I think. They know it, so they don't know what it is, but they know what it does, which is it holds gravity, it holds the cosmos in place, whereas dark energy is causing the expansion, which can't really be explained in any other way, of the universe. Now, I would see those two forces from a spiritual perspective, and I'm stressing it, this is my take on it. This isn't straight from the Ethereum Society or straight from Dr. King. I would see those two forces, dark matter, as the preservative force that's holding matter in being, and dark energy, the expansive force, being the creative force. I would call them preservation and creation, those two forces. But I would see them as aspects of God, of divinity, of Brahma, whatever word you want to use. So right at the highest end of the 12 blessings, for those who are familiar with it, you have the 10th blessing, as I mentioned, which is the galaxy. Now, the galaxies are there to hold, you know, my understanding of it is that astronomers will see a sort of conglomeration of stars and planets and call that a galaxy. But actually, I believe the galaxy came first, and then within it were brought the stars, the suns, to enable them to evolve. And it's the galaxy which is holding it in being. It's a preservative force. And then above even that, when you get to the 11th blessing here, so I'll just finish my point, you've got the supreme lords of creation, and they are causing this expansion, all of which, though, all of it is devised to enable, through creation and through preservation, life to evolve, which is the purpose of life, to evolve back to ultimately the 12th blessing, which is God. There's my little theory, Dallas.
This is the thing. I'm not a.
It's not just a theory either. It's based on an experience.
Yeah. Well, you're right. But the thing is about science is that there's a thing in philosophy. They call it the God of the gaps. That anytime we don't know something in science, we go, God did it, and then science encroaches into that area, and God is pushed further and further away into.
It doesn't need to be, does it? I mean, the two could both be true.
I
could understand God better. I think Einstein was of that view. I might be wrong.
Einstein was very much an atheist.
Although he did refer to God, did he not?
He did refer to God, but he referred to God as in God does not play dice, which is the famous Einstein quotation.
Okay.
He meant it within talking about the mathematics. Okay. And statistics.
Did he not say something like there's no religion without science and no science without religion? No, he made a statement along those lines, I think.
I think he did, but he's also, he I can say with a fair degree of certainty, he wasn't actually a believer in, certainly in the supernatural, if we want to call it that. He was very much a man of science. But no, dark matter and dark energy.
You can be both.
Of course, and there are lots of
science. Maybe you are, Dallas, a man at your both.
Yeah, I'm certainly a seeker. I'm not a believer in supernaturalism or God. Yeah. I'm not. But that's interesting you say that, because it's not, you know, I enjoy reading about religions. I'm very interested in religions, why religions are the way they are. I'm drawn, you know, I love like anyone else. I love sitting in a church and listening to music. I get that. I get it. I'm not some kind of heathen who's like, religions are stupid. You know, I don't see it like that. I see religions as a very human thing. I just happen to think they are a human invention rather than an outside invention.
Often the structure of them is. But, you know, I've had people saying to me, I don't like organized religion. I can see why they say that. And I can say, what do you want then? Disorganized religion. Because, it's just a fact. You have to organize things if you want to get anything done. Was Dr. King
agree.
It's not like, okay, religion isn't just there to bring you comfort, to help you get married, to take your... I've taken a funeral service myself very recently, sadly enough, but of a great friend of mine. But it isn't just there for that. It's a functional, active, proactive force, which can be used, if it's organized correctly and is performing the right practices, to really help the world.
Yes.
And that's how he saw it. And I think if religions... You know, I'm quite often, I'm not going to name any, I've had a bit of a go at Christianity. I don't really want to do that because there's wonderful things done by Christian movements as well in the world, even today. And it's a fantastic thing. And I'm a respecter of all religions. But, you know, I've sometimes been disappointed. I'm now thinking of other religions. They just become a cultural thing and nothing more. And people will opt for the religion, if they are religious at all, that they were born into. There's no reason whatsoever to believe something's true because you were born into it.
Correct. That was Christopher Hitchens' big argument about it.
Yeah, I think that's a good argument then.
My God doesn't exist.
Yeah.
It's like, how come you're always born into the
world? Just because you're born into an atheistic family doesn't mean there's no God either.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a question of making the search. But so often it just becomes a sort of family... orientated social cultural thing, whereas actually it can be a living force, and that's what Dr. King wanted to make it, and that's what the Ethereum site is, as you probably know, is a relatively small, really tiny, I suppose, relative to the world as a whole in numbers on this level, I have to add, organization, but extremely active. Very, very. I mean, I've had priests say to me, "My God, I'd give anything to have your congregation." You know, because we have very, very active people who get engaged, even in small numbers, and even around the world, be it Jack, be it somebody in, Jamaica, be it somebody in Iran, or wherever they may be, it may be safe, it may not be safe wherever they are to do this, but they get engaged and they get on and they say everybody can send out spiritual energy.
Presumably that's because you make a very good point, actually, which is the big major monotheistic faiths, Abrahamic faiths, have been around for so long. And one is born, you know, a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim.
Yeah.
And you just take for granted that that's the way that things are. Whereas something like the Ethereum Society, which is presumably a lot smaller, people actually actively have to find it.
They have to. And it's much more difficult because you've got to change your not only change your upbringing conceptions, whatever they may be, but your past life. And I'm going into another area, so forgive me. But, you know, I'm sure of reincarnation. I don't just believe in it. I'm sure of reincarnation. And, through the various lives that we have, we develop what the Hindus or the yogis anyway would call samskaras, which are habitual thought patterns. And you know, people do that in this life, and you get on kind of a tape loop of thought, and it's a certain type of thinking. So that you're absolutely right. So you come back, you hear about, you know, Jesus, the one and only Son of God, the virgin birth, the etc., the resurrection, and it doesn't sound strange as possibly it should sound, because you've heard this, but maybe in many lives, whether you have followed it or not, it's a familiar thing. But you come along and you hear that Dr. King channeled beings from Mars, and that sounds very odd to a lot of people. But there's no, they don't have, certainly if you're of my generation or a bit younger than my generation even, you don't have the past life experiences and familiarity with these concepts, which don't make it sound so strange in your subconscious. But then I think the more advanced person can see through how things look and just get to the truth without, and I don't think, with all due respect, that's true of all the scientists I've met. Certainly it's true of what I know of you. But a lot of scientists have their own dogmas, Dallas. They have their own prejudices, and they don't investigate. They will all immediately conclude something is false just on the basis of how it sounds to them.
That's because scientists are humans.
Yeah. The same is true of religious people too. So.
It is, you know, and anyway, that's the...
And atheistic
people. I kind of believe in reincarnation, and I believe in reincarnation in the sense that we are all made, as Carl Sagan reminded us, of star stuff. We're all process of stellar nucleation. Stars explode.
Sunlight, solidified sunlight.
Well, the elements of stars when they explode, the periodic table, if you like, is us. We are all made of that. Yeah. We will all return to dust. We will get consumed by our sun in X billion years' time, and that process will continue. So we're all, you know, energy cannot be made or created, it can only be transformed. So we're all made of the same stuff.
I mean, one of the things about reincarnation, which I've sort of come to realize quite recently actually, is that once one accepts reincarnation, and I think probably billions of people do, I'm not sure what the number is, but a lot of believers in reincarnation from various, I think the Druze actually are a Christian sect that believes in reincarnation. But either way, most people who do believe in reincarnation think that it's a good thing. I think it's a necessary thing, but it's not of itself a good thing. It's something that we need to do. And the reason that we need to reincarnate, in my take on it, is in order to reconnect with our souls. Now, you probably part company with me at this moment. But I think there's a lot of soul, you know, people talk about mind repression, they talk about sexual repression, emotional repression. I think there's a lot of soul repression in our world. It goes on, it's done instinctively. And we have to reincarnate, because when we die, and it brings us back to something we were talking about earlier, which I mentioned, say, life on Venus, life on Mars, they are aware, they are living not only on the physical, but on the etheric realm as well. That's even if they're using the physical at all. There is no disparity in their thinking. Here there is. So the reason we reincarnate is to gain experience. Then we need to die. We need to die, most of us, unless we're advanced enough, so that we can have a period on these etheric realms when we can reconnect with our soul so that we can determine our next life. Ultimately, and I do believe the time will come on this planet, when we won't need to do that at all. There are already intelligences on this planet who don't need to, such as ones by the name of Count Saint Germain, and there are others who don't need to do that. But there'll come a time when we won't need to go through that reincarnation process at all, because we will be connected with our souls without needing to go through that.
Do you not think that reincarnation is a very human-centric thing and a way of dealing with the fact that we find this idea that somehow we survive our own death as a sort of a comfort, because we don't like staring into the void?
Could I make a suggestion to you, if I may? Yes. I've noticed a couple of times.
I smile on my face because I know you'll disagree with me.
No, it's not that. It's that you have this, I think I'm right in saying, this idea that people are sort of looking for escape routes and looking for something they want to believe in, and therefore coming up with it because they want to believe in it. And I still come back to my point. I think it's actually human beings are just as likely, if not more likely, to disbelieve in it out of prejudice and out of conditioning. But yeah, are there some people who'll do that because they want to? No doubt. There may be. But I that doesn't preclude it. I mean, you know, reincarnation is something that you can actually prove again to yourself if you take it far enough through memory. But you'd have to really, you'd have to really work intensely in a certain yogic area and concentrate on it to do that. And that may not be your priority. You can also discover it by contacting people who have died. And that's been done by many people, including myself and many others. And they'll tell you because they've experienced it and they're waiting to come back. You can also do it through astral projection. Now, those are all spiritual methodologies, if you like, which you can use and which don't prove it. I acknowledge that in a sort of physical scientific laboratory sense.
No, I do. It's just interesting that culturally all the world religions have a "this is what happens when you die" story. You go to heaven. You're reincarnated.
I think it's an important one, don't you? I think that's. Well, I mean,
but that's my point. Just isn't that a very human need that we need to make sense?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe it's and you can call it a need, yes, and you can call it a soul-driven desire, even.
Yeah.
The quest for truth. I mean, do you have a need to know about quasars and dwarfs? I mean, white dwarfs and so on. I mean, it's a pursuit of truth. And I think the truth about life after death is something absolutely critical and well worth pursuing.
Just while we're on the subject of truth and quasars and white dwarfs, one of the things I was interested in sort of Dr. King moving from the 50s through to the 90s, I know when he died, 97, I think he died.
97, yeah, well done, yeah.
In the sort of 1950s, particularly the early 50s, we would look at Mars and we were still talking about canals on Mars.
Yeah.
And there was still that idea of, in fact, I remember Patrick Moore in an old episode of Sky Night talking about, we still think there may be vegetation on Mars.
Mm.
That idea of life on Mars seemed to be there, although it was started to be doubted. When our telescopes got bigger and we could see the surface of Mars, and now we have rovers on Mars and we drive around on Mars, and it's there. Why is it we can look back at the Earth and we can see life and we can see things, but when we look at Mars, we see ostensibly a sort of dead planet?
Mm.
Why can't we see people on Mars then?
Oh, I see. Well, it's a very simple reason that we can't. That's assuming we know one's ever seen anyone on Mars, by the way.
We've got robots.
Like conversation. It will be because the inhabitants of Mars, there'll be two reasons. The main one will be the inhabitants don't wish to be seen by probes or by whoever. They'll be fully aware of whatever, you know, endeavors are being made to see them. And they will not wish it to be done at this time. And the other main reason is that they especially now, and especially since the late 60s, so this is later than the 50s you're talking about, they inhabit these higher etheric realms far more than we do. They don't need to use the physical level at all. Evolution throughout the universe is such that it's an all transmuting process. So as it's transmuted, we're going to higher and higher and higher levels. Some people actually on this earth have demonstrated invisibility. One is Dr. King himself. He did disappear on at least two occasions when he was intensely engaged in his yoga. But the reason is by raising one's internal vibrations to a higher spiritual level. So, you know, I know that some people will find this highly dubious, what I'm saying now, but I can only say what I believe to be true. And that is that the reason they won't see them is either one, because the beings there don't wish to be seen, or most likely because they're not inhabiting the physical level at all.
And did that change when Dr. King was thinking about this? Because what I mean is, in the 1950s, yeah, popular culture was replete with little green men, men from Mars. And then we actually looked at Mars. And went, oh, actually,
I think it did change. I think, first of all, I don't, you see, when you look at Dr. King now at the end in 1997 and where he ended up, and certainly in the years that I knew him, he knew far more, not really just so much from scientific evidence, but from what he had discovered, you know, on the spiritual planes and through his activities than he knew in the 1950s. So in 1958, for example, there's an encounter he had actually near where I am now in Putney Common with his own master. And he asked a question, this very same question I come back to, on your planet, which was Mars, so we're talking about Mars, do you have contact with your etheric realm? And he got a very detailed answer and a very full answer, actually, which I is a fascinating topic in itself. And it's covered in a thing called The Four Aspects of Creation. And he gave a lecture on it. But in a nutshell, though, tells me also that in 1958, he didn't know. It suggests to me that he, Dr. King, didn't know that how the other planets operated. By the time I met him, he did. The fact that he would even ask the question, do you have the same interaction with your etheric realms, would suggest that to me. And then he learned. And then so what he was learning and what he was being told and what he was discovering was evolving. Yeah. And then I also believe a critical thing happened in 1969, which is known as the initiation of the solar system, which was published, which he did reveal at the time, which was a raising of the vibrations on the other planets in this solar system to higher levels, so that those that might have been visible were much less likely to be visible. And this had a very good reason to operate on this physical plane. So that all that was going on throughout his, as you might say, his tenure as primary terrestrial mental channel.
I just, because you obviously follow science, you know a lot about science, and you read.
I don't know a lot. I don't claim to. I know, but I'm interested. But
I mean, you're interested, and I'm just wondering how much of that scientific knowledge, as science changes, as we become more, you know, our probes and telescopes get better, how much of that actually changes changes the Ethereum Society's view.
Well, I mean, Dr. King, I mean, I do remember when I used to go and stay with him, and when I did stay in LA, which is very frequent, he would very often be watching various things on television in the evening sometimes, and among them would be astronomy programs. And I do remember watching a whole series about what life was like as far as they knew then. This would probably be maybe the early 90s, perhaps, you know, on the surface of Jupiter, on the surface. So he's fully aware of, you know, what was. You know, he wasn't an expert. I don't think he'd claim that, but he knew broadly what was being said about life on Mars, Venus, Jupiter, you know, on this Earth. But that wasn't his source. And I keep coming back to the higher dimensional life, which exists. In fact, I found there's a quite a rare, extremely complicated book called The Serpent Power. It's a theosophical book by Sir John Woodruff. And it's about Kundalini, which is of great interest to me, or certainly has been in the recent years. But, and I know it's of great interest to Jack as well, Kundalini, as it happens. But in it, though, he identifies a Sanskrit source which details different levels of there's a word for it, and it's a Sanskrit word, and it eludes me right now. But it breaks down the various elements and into various types. And then it breaks down levels of mind going up through higher levels through what we might call the soul all the way to the spirit. And there are 25 of them. And these are all levels that were known about, I don't know whether certainly hundreds, probably thousands of years, well, definitely would be known about thousands of years ago. The text, I don't know how old it was that Sir John Woodruff discovered. So this is something which is absolutely framed Dr. King's whole approach to everything, actually. I mean, he, whereas, you know, I, as you know, I think, because you've read The King Who Came to Earth, which I was honored to co-author, which is his biography. And thank you. But he was totally focused in his early years on spiritual, inner spiritual development. So I believe he came from another world, which is what the Hindus would call an avatar, a divine incarnation, they would call it. But I believe it means he came from another world. And I would also believe that Gandhi came from another world, actually. And I would also believe, just to take some recent examples, that Swami Sivananda came from another world. So those three are 20th century figures, I would say were avatars. Now, whereas Gandhi was focused in his earlier years on the law, especially learning the law, you know, becoming a lawyer and a, you know, human rights campaigner and politics. And Swami Sivananda was an accomplished medical doctor, and he was studying that all those years just as intensely, at least as intensely. Dr. King was focused on the inner spiritual planes for 8 hours a day. And this is extremely unusual. So it's from that he drew his knowledge of life on other planets. This is the real point. Brings me right back to my Nani Yoga point. Spiritual experience, meditation being the root to which you then apply a logic, which is missed out, I think, in physical science.
I think the thing that I find so extraordinary about Dr. George King is the fact that he practiced, as you say, for 8 hours a day.
I know.
Not only that, but also had a job and had to earn money and do everything else. It wasn't, he lived, as you say, he wasn't like living in a...
You're right. I find it extraordinary too. And you know, when we were doing the biography, I wanted to find out, because I mean, I met him in the 70s and I started to become close to him, sort of really, I mean, he actually made me secretary when I was 26 in 1979. So, you know, and I still hold the position today. So, and he gave it to me. So I've known him a long time, but I really got close to him and became a friend of his during the 80s and into the 90s. I wanted to find out very, very much whether the Dr. King that I knew was the same Dr. King that was in the 50s and in the 60s. That, you know, basically, did he go through a change, or was he always like the way I knew, which, and the way I knew him was completely dedicated to his task, totally single-minded, totally focused. You know, he had a great sense of humor. He could be very practical. He could be relaxed, although he was also, I think that he I won't call it stressed, but he bore a lot of problems on his shoulders and worries, I will say. I think his biggest critic would have to admit he lived what he believed, whatever they think of what he believed. So I found out, though, from talking to a whole variety, especially his wife and people like Charles Abrahams and others who were close to him. And I went even earlier than that, to the 50s, people who knew him then. And I concluded he was the same. Excuse me. And from that, I would draw the conclusion, the period you're talking about, which is the sort of late 40s, early 50s, when he was doing yoga for 8 hours a day and a job. He was the same then, too, I think. This was a person, if he decided to do something, that was it. He didn't have any diversions, distractions. This is what he set out to do. And he set out to really find truth within himself and find out his psyche. And he had to have certain psychic abilities. We mentioned levitation, but he had to be able to project at will and so on, part of his mission on Earth. And he accomplished this, and he accomplished it, I think, without, I mean, the job that he did, which was often driving, sometimes driving a taxi. I mean, I've even had people rule him out as being a great being because he was a taxi driver, believe it or not. Probably not so much now. There used to be a bit of snobbishness, but, you know, that if he'd been a high court judge, would he be more legitimate? I mean, it was pathetic. And his answer to that was actually when he had an encounter with Jesus, Master Jesus on Holston Down, he said the heading should be Carpenter Meets Taxi Driver on Hill in Devon. That was his sense of humor, because it's so ridiculous. But he did it to make money, just purely so that he could do his yoga, and he would do whatever was required. He didn't have money. He had to work.
Next time I go to a yoga class, I'm going to think of that. Hey, listen, it's hard work. It's hard work running and founding your own religion.
There are problems attached, and having sort of stood by his side throughout many of them, and I will say he was incredibly rigorous when it came to planning for after his demise. He didn't just leave it and say, you know, he went into absolute, and I was with him a lot in that period, detailed planning about not only who would do what, but how it would run after him. He was completely committed, and I believe still is completely committed to the continuity of the Aetherius Society and his mission.
Good. How are we doing, Jack?
Well, it's been a wonderful conversation. So
we're only an hour and a half. I haven't started yet. This is just a warm-up.
How long have we done?
Yeah.
An hour and a half. How long are we meant to do?
Knows.
Is it 90 minutes, I think, I was told?
I have a podcast series, and we're very strict. We're like, half an hour, that's it.
Okay. What's your podcast series, Dallas? I must check it out.
It's called Patented, History of Inventions.
Oh, excellent.
And I also do a podcast series for the UK Space Agency in orbit, which looks at, you know, current goings on in the UK space industry and the global space.
Oh, excellent. Oh, good.
And I'm writing
it. Check it out. Yeah. You're kind enough to follow my podcast, so I'm definitely
going to... I love your podcast. I know. It's lovely to see you again, Richard. I really enjoy our chat.
And we'll hook up and we'll talk about the other thing you mentioned to me. And I'll tell you what's happening with that. But I'm not going to do it live on here.
Yeah, I'll give you a ring in the next few days.
Yeah, please do.
I'll pop down and have a coffee. Yeah, it'd be nice.
Yeah, yeah, you'd be more than welcome. It'd be lovely to see you again.
Inviting himself for coffee.
Sorry. No, you are invited. You are invited, Dallas.
And I want to come at some point in 2024. I want to come up to Devon and do some battery charging.
Yeah, be great. And you know, we have mountains, as you know, around the UK, and they're great filming opportunities too, as well, because they're beautifully picturesque, apart from anything else.
Yeah,
Jack.
Well, listen, thanks.
Promise now, sir.
Yeah, just thanks so much, Dallas, because it's great to have
somebody. Thanks for bringing us together, Jack.
Well, it's my pleasure, but it's great to have a science.
Thank you for having me. I'm probably not the normal guest you get on your podcast series, so it's fun to... I hope I haven't said anything too...
You know, can I just add in something, Jack, if I may? And that is, I'd like to congratulate you, Jack, and Deborah, I know who works with you, on your 100th show.
Wow.
And what an honour to be on it. Thank you very much indeed. Well done.
It's been a real highlight, and this has been the best episode so far. And you have contrasting beliefs, but the fact that you, Dallas, are still so open-minded to be interested in the Aetherius Society is great.
Yeah, no, and also they do great work. And it's not, you know.
But we respect each other, you know. I think that's the key.
Yeah, beautiful. Absolutely. Well, thanks so much.
Well done with all you're doing, Jack. You're doing great work, and good luck with it.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Richard. That means a lot.
God bless.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye, Dallas.
Bye. See you soon.